and solar is absurd because of their northern latitude. I think that Ontario is probably at least as northern latitude as Germany. The insulation, maximum insulation, is about 1 kilowatt per square meter at noon on a clear day at the equator. And when you're further north, your solar insulation drops, and of course in the wintertime, the sun often doesn't appear at all, but you still need energy. So I'm not sure why Germany's trying to replace coal with, actually they're not trying to replace coal, by the way. Germany's actually phasing out nuclear as their priority. They've shut down 8 nuclear plants, they've got 9 left, and those 9 are running almost full bore, but they plan to shut those down very soon. They like building lignite plants, 25 new lignite plants under construction or starting up in the last couple of years. So that's not a model that I would follow.
And actually to what Scott said, Toronto. Hi, I'm a Liberal Democrat, and so that means probably somebody who would live in downtown Toronto, so I guess that's a lefty person. And so, of course, supposedly they're all green, you know, and
we ride bikes,
and all that's, you know, and yay, you know, my people, yay, but I'm still pro-nuclear, and I think that it is ideological, but there are things that go along with, there are certain beliefs that go along with the ideology, and climate change is a biggie. I don't know whether Pandora's Promise has played here yet. Okay, so there you go. That's your blueprint right there. There's messages all over the place there. You can just pull them right out, and you see that here are these 5 people who, because of concerns about climate change and social justice, by the way, they're now pro-nuclear. And I think, although it may be difficult for the nuclear industry, even in Canada. I love Canada. It's like, you guys are, it's a blue state. It's a blue state utopia. To have credibility, it is an issue of here, but you know, it may be difficult to have credibility using social justice messages. One, you should try, and two, no white guys delivering the message. Seriously. So, you know, you're going to have to go to Toronto, and you're going to have to go to Earth Day, and you're going to be there, Ontario Power Generation and Bruce Power, and also Cameco. I don't know if there's any Cameco people here in the room, but it's like, you know, okay, fantastic, good. You know, and I guess SNC-Lavalin has to be there, and presumably ECL has to be there, and you guys all need to be there, and OCI, and you need to have some courage, and you need to do it. Democrats are the problem and the solution. You know, liberals, what are they called here? Labor Party? I don't know. What's your left here? Okay. Right. So, but they're the problem and the solution. Because that's where the anti-nuclear and environmental movement sits. And same thing in the U.S. It's the Democratic Party has to own it. That's my party. And so I'm challenging them, and I'm taking it back. And as for base load, you know, this guy, Sigmar Gabriel, well, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Because energy, I can tell you, Energy Northwest is base load following right now. I mean, wreaking havoc on what they're doing, but they're doing it. And also SMRs will be able to base load. So think about that.
A couple of things. On the basic point, the point is you need to meet peak demand when you're operating a system. And if you have 100% coal, terrific. Add lots of wind. You'll displace coal, you'll displace gas. What we're talking about is displacing the generating capacity itself. So if you introduce things that are intermittent, say we'll take it whenever we get it because it's good. good because it's displacing coal. Well, it's not displacing coal. People do not know if the wind's going to blow. You still need the full capacity. So it's not displacing the coal plant. It's displacing the coal. Let's talk about solar in Germany. Last year, about 4.3% of their power generation. I think it's about 8,000 gigawatts a year of capacity they had in the last 3 years. They changed their feed-in tariff. They said, if we keep adding at this level, we're going to go broke. So they have a regression, right? They hit the numbers, the price drops. And the price is down, you know, I just talked about capacity, so grid parity is a funny thing. You know, if you're not paying for the full capacity, you can get grid parity, but it's not really honest. But they're basically there at 4.3% of capacity because they put the brakes on because it's too expensive. So I'm not sure that's a scalable solution anywhere. Their wind has also grown much slower, much, much slower since 2005 than their biomass. And isn't that strange in Ontario? We know Germany has 22-23% of the production from renewables, but we don't realize they get more of that from biomass than they do from solar, and the biomass is growing quicker than the wind. So, yeah, I think your point, you know, is valid in that. Sure, Germany had a lot of fossil fuels. It made sense for them to put in something to use less fossil fuel. In terms of catching up to Ontario, never going to happen. Clean baseload, I think that's the way to go and to stay.
Also, I'd just add that, look at the bottom line. They did this for to cut carbon emissions. Their carbon emissions went up. They're using combustible fuels went up. It's less of a problem. I'd like to hear them explain it.
Also, I think in terms of messaging, talking about the grid is a non-starter. You can't. In 140 characters on a tweet, it's not going to work. So even when you go in and talk to politicians in Toronto, you have to explain, you have to start very basic and explain to them physics and how electricity does what it wants to do, and that's why intermittent doesn't work, and that's why you need baseload power from nuclear. I mean, seriously basic. But if you wanna talk to some people who, you know, live in downtown Toronto, it's just a non-starter. They don't understand what you're talking about. Okay, really. I mean, what did I say? Local? Stupid. Just remember that.
So just more of a comment than a question. I want to take the risk and sound like the optimist in the room, if that's okay. So I think there's two issues. I've been really interested in the panelists' sort of feedback on this. The first is on the message. So I work for Bruce Power. We spent a lot of time on focus grouping, a whole series of TV ads we've been running for the past year, hours and hours and hours. And we focused on women who live in urban centers. So there's the message is very simple. Four words. Nuclear up, coal down. That's it. Nothing else. But the one thing I think that is really important here is we need to make sure we don't perpetuate a myth that we're unpopular. Does anyone know what's the support for reefer is the province? I'm not going to ask wrong because I never know.
7 years.
More than 2 years.
Yeah, 74%. A year and a half ago, it was 63%. We were lowest in support in the GTA in Central Ontario. So when Bruce Power went and put our ads on the air, and I don't want to say how much we spent, but it was a considerable investment. We focused it on the GTA in Central Ontario. In Central Ontario, our support went up 21% in 6 months. In Toronto, went up 10%. So when we're talking to elected leaders and politicians, I think we need to get crisper on the message. But we need to say them. We're not going to go higher than 74, 75% support. We're not. So when is enough? We've had this discussion with the province. You will not find any public policy issue out there. You can pull it on education, healthcare, you name it, where it pulls better than 75%. we've also been tracking is the level of support for coal phase out of Ontario. It was 89% 2 years ago. It's actually dropped 10 points, you don't know why? Because all the folks that you're talking about that believe in the GTA that we can phase out coal through wind and solar, now that they've been educated, they're like, I don't know if I'm quite like coal phase out if it's nuclear. So there's actually been this intersection between coal phase out support dropping and nuclear support going up. Now we should care about that because it's our numbers going up. But it is very interesting with that crisp of a message how the numbers will move quickly. And I would say, just, and I don't certainly want to dominate the discussion, but what other, we're going to spend $20 billion refurbishing University of Arlington. Great for our economy. We sure should make an investment in advertising. We're going to spend $20 billion, passing the hat around here, but what other industries are spending $20 billion?
Natural gas.
And they're spending less than $20 billion, and they're advertising more. So we need to make sure CNA and other organizations, OCI, are quick to do that, because putting money on the air is the only way, or ads on the air is the only way to move the public.
I'd like to cheer for you, because I really like your ads. And I also want to cheer because something about advertising, people in industry sometimes forget, but advertising is not only a good way to reach the public, but advertising is a great way to make friends in the media. Think about it for a second. Where does the media get its income from? If you're not advertising or showing up in the media, you're a free game. You're an easy target. If you're an advertiser, the media is a lot more gentle with you. Think about it for a bit.
So, a couple of years ago, there was an earthquake in central Virginia. And the two Surrey plants that are owned by Dominion were affected. The Nuclear Energy Institute, which is the big trade association in the U.S. and it's based in D.C., has been advertising on one of this local radio station's affiliates. NEI sponsors, well, you guys will know, the Washington Capitals, okay? And it's like one of the few brilliant things that NEI has ever done. And let me tell you, WTOP, the radio station, is the news and traffic leader, in the metro area by far. There was no negative reporting about that earthquake, ladies and gentlemen. So, and I was in, Toronto, Pearson, and I'm thinking, well, where's all the, hey, OPG and Bruce Power, you should be advertising here. And I'm sure, I assume, I haven't been to Saskatchewan in a long time, but I assume that Canada was all over the place there. You need to do more. I'll tell Tim, no problem.
I just want to come back to Joel Madden, because like you said, I'd come back to him. You guys all know his name because he advertises. This is why he's got such name recognition. And that's something that is a message that everybody should know. You have to repeat. Not repeat like a robot. You can be creative about repeating, but you have to repeat. Don't under-communicate your message. So when we're talking about advertising, that's a fantastic idea to do it. But just understand what it takes in order to get your message across. It takes an awful lot of work.
I think there's another question from Milton.
I just want to bring the discussion back to the social media thing a little bit, because I think what we've proven by listening to James is that in order to get outside of our traditional, like, we're good at talking to each other in the industry, right? We all, everyone here is in the industry, we talk to each other while saying it's good for us. But what James is showing is that it still takes traditional media to break out and access people that, you're trying to get information to that are not your core groups of supporters. And that's sort of where I'm wrestling with social media these days. The pro is that all of us can write what we want and get our point across. The con is that it's becoming a vehicle where very like-minded people tend to read or the people that hate you, you know, and read that stuff. But I think other than that, so the question is, how do we break out, right? How do we break out and get readership beyond our traditional base? And that's why the Pandora's Promise thing, you get someone like Mark Linus, they have a different, he has a different readership. You know, I remember earlier this year, because he's also prolific, writing about the anti-GMO and supporting GMO. And, you know, he did a talk and he put it out on Twitter and he had over 500,000, you know, hits. And, you know, we don't get that kind of a following. So I'm interested in your thoughts on how we break up. By the way, while you're happy about us being very blue, have you seen our mayor on TV? Like your views on
just before I turn it over to the panel, I'll make it look like I'm actually doing some work up there. I'm glad Milt asked that question, because that was actually almost my lead-in question, so you're taking my work away from me. That's awesome. Milt up all down. My question was in a way a little bit similar. You brought up the question of traditional media is great because it's structured, hits a lot of people. You typically have budgets that can really focus on messages like Bruce Bauer did. Find it right now, the four words, and probably our industry doesn't do unstructured very well. We're sort of trained not to do that, and improvisation is typically not, it's typically frowned upon in any engineering discipline. So how would you see, you know, to add to Milt's question, how do you see we use social media, the unstructured part of social media, and that sort of crazy madness, you know, a couple of times I've posted and I've been called a mass murderer and blocked off websites and stuff like that, so that sort of soured my experience. Yeah, thank you. So, you know, by the way, I haven't killed anyone. So I think that's maybe if, I hope I can sort of dovetail off Milt's question.
One of the things I'd like to say is don't ignore traditional media. Use it to advertise your social media. Take advantage of both media. No, don't, I mean, social media is not replacing old media, it's supplementing it. And I've actually embedded Bruce Power's expensively created videos that they paid to run on other people's media outlets. I've embedded those in my blog and continue to help them repurpose those messages. If you have a good campaign going on social media, use traditional media to direct people to it. So that you can then, once you bring them in and start talking to them, now you can use some of the, you know, the other tools. But don't ignore one. Build the campaign. It's all about communicating and finding how, where are the potential audience, and how do I reach them, and how do I try to get them into my message?
Yeah, I'd say that in addition to advertising, another way to, I don't want to say use traditional media, but another way to work with traditional media, another sort of goal in working with traditional media is to find your way into the editorial part of it or into the beat reporter part of it, because if you get written up in something like that, that's also worth something. It's worth, it might be worth as much as what you pay for advertising, where you completely control the message, but people know that it's advertising. If you get written up by a reporter in a decent way, I don't know how to measure those kinds of points, but I think that it's worth something. And I think that a lot of social media aims could be towards getting a foothold in traditional media that way.
And they like Twitter, and they feel really comfortable with it. In addition to Twitter, there's Instagram, there's Pinterest, there's Prezi, there's a million different, every day it seems like something new is coming out. I think too that reporters actually do troll and pay attention to Twitter feeds. I recently was at another conference as a panelist, and a journalist said that websites are flat and dead and boring, and of course you have to have them, but Twitter is better. It's more immediate. And then I think lastly, Mel, you might want to do some research into groups that are trying to solve problems. You know, I mean, we all have confirmation bias, right? You know, if you have a certain worldview, then you're going to listen to certain news programs and you're going to subscribe to certain newspapers, and that's human. Even engineers do it, even though they have all the facts. So everyone does it. But in order to cross-pollinate, you have to go out of your way, I think, to reach out and define those communities in the same way that they've done the same thing. You know, I mean, there are, most people aren't big picture thinkers, but there are a lot who are. And so I assume just in Toronto, well, in the greater Toronto area, there's no way there couldn't be other such groups. And so I think one of the things that we need to do better is build bridges to other communities. So we have to build bridges to environmentalists, and we have to build bridges to the nuclear medical community big time. We have to build bridges to the industrial use nuclear community big time. Because we're all nuclear, I mean, it's all the same. Radiation is radiation, so. And I think too, you know, once you tap into some of those communities, I think Rod actually might have a better idea of that, because he's been invited to some conferences where it's like broader. It's not just nuclear people, it's people who are terrified about energy and the economy and the environment and standards of living in a world that's going to have 8 billion people, most of whom are going to be poor and won't have access to electricity. So there's actually a lot going on out.
Well, you know, I think I stated you have broader reach in traditional media already. As a writer, you have to make compromises to get in media on your position. Certainly, if you're a co-writer, you know, you don't exactly share opinions, but you can get the message out in exactly the way you want that's going to be of interest to 200,000 people. Maybe the case, right? I'd like to go back just to the statement on elections, just because I have the numbers in my head. When you say 37% of the people voted, that's 30% of the people who voted for the government, and less than half the people voted. One of the fascinating stats I've encountered in the past 3 years, there was a fewer percentage of eligible voters voted for the Liberal Party of Ontario than there had been in, I think, 60 years. They actually received fewer votes than they did, fewer votes as a percentage of eligible voters than they did in the first loss to Mike Harris, in the mass of Mike Harris. So there's a thing about getting people to believe in stuff, where if you have 25% of the people on your side, you can do really well if they're really on your side. Japan election was also pretty fascinating, by the way, in terms of everybody was 70% were anti-nuclear, or 80% or whatever, but the most pro-nuclear party won. It's great for a blog to end up with press. You really look for things to get free press. You always want to get free press. It's not an either or. I think a communication strategy has a website to control the communication message, which I think you have to do. You have to control the message. You can't just say, let's set 100 bloggers out on the world and support them. Twitter's great for a message. You've only got so many characters anyway. I think writing's great for writing. Whether you're an advocate or whatever you are, pick up a pen, grab a keyboard, and write something. You'll learn something. You'll learn something about yourself. You'll learn something about a topic. Social media is a way to say, I'm advocating for something. This is terrific. I learned something. I want to get it out. Get it out. You get it to the press. That 90 terawatt hour achievement, you know somewhere in early January, the ISO is going to that's how you can kind of take daily events, time to your message, and try to spread them to the press. But if you don't spread them to the press, you can publish them yourself, and maybe something.
I'm just going to add a little bit here. Robert Mock, I run a social media marketing company, a digital marketing company, and I'm a TV show host, so I sort of straddle both worlds. I do traditional media, and I do a lot of digital media as well, and very, very proud to work with OCI on a lot of their digital initiatives. One of the things I would say is the aims of traditional media and social are often very different. And I think one of the things that, to augment a little bit about what we're saying here, is to remember a lot of the aims of social should be exactly that, is social, and I think that that's often missed. It's seen as another arena to put our stuff, right? To put my blog out, to put my message out, to put my information out, but we also have to remember that there's an expectation that you will be social. Go out and engage. Engage in conversations, engage in different groups, talk to them, start building a rapport and a relationship with them, and then they're much more likely to participate. The goal shouldn't just be to push the information out, but to get the users who are interacting with that message to continue to push the message along for it. So if your organization has 500 people who are connected with its LinkedIn page, for example, that's great. If you push a message out, those 500 people have the opportunity to see it. But the second any of those 500 people begin interacting, liking, sharing, commenting on that article, you create another ripple in the pond, and more people progressively see, hear, and experience that message. But they're only going to do that, A, if you're creating good content that they like. So if I get to the end of that blog post and go, wow, that was great, I need to share that with people, that's the kind of content that needs to be created, but also building that relationship where it is a bit of a two-way street. It's not just, here's my stuff. I know you're going to jump on and you're going to engage as well. You're as interested in my opinions as you are in ensuring that I hear yours.
I just want to do a quick follow-up on the social aspects. Don't forget that part of what I think that we really need to do as an industry is to personalize and explain to people why we're so excited about the technology, and I hope you are, but it's not, the message that you can share in social media needs to be not a corporate top-down message, it needs to be a personalized message, and get some people who really explain what it is they're excited about, and to build that relationship. It's also important to build that relationship at a time when things are kind of quiet, and get people understanding what you do and start trusting you, because that's the only way you're going to be effective if you have some kind of need for crisis communication. You can't do crisis communication if you don't have a relationship already, or at least you can't do it very effectively.
Again, I'm having to do precious little work out here, which is great. I'm hoping there's going to be more audience participation. But I want to actually ask one question here, and I think it sort of brings a couple of things together. And actually, it brings a little bit of what Jared started at the end of our AGM. He was talking about radiophobia and especially this, what seems to be an almost poisonous radiophobia, which is really undercutting our message because it seems to be driven by blind fear and hopefully. Ignorance. However, on the other hand, we're talking about 75% support of refurbishment, which is, as Bruce Power mentioned, probably the highest you'll ever get to support anything except, you know, maybe puppies. But on the other side, you know, Andrew pointed out that, you know, don't back down. So this is a good news story, but on the other hand, don't back down on people who attack you. Now, I know Rod has worked a lot. I've read a couple of things that he's written about the actual effects of Fukushima. I think Fukushima was sort of a body blow for us, because we kind of saw Chernobyl happen all over again. So how do we reconcile these messages of, you know, there's the really positive side, but also how do we engage the people who are literally talking about a worldwide apocalypse, like Harvey Wasserman is saying, possibly the whole northern hemisphere has to be evacuated to Australia because we're all going to die. Maybe I'll throw that to Roger first.
First of first of all, Australia would be an awfully crowded place that way. Secondly, one of the things I am trying to do is to help people remember that no matter how many times we've been told that the sky is falling, it's still up there. These apocalyptic scenarios that have been running around on, and they're not really in the mainstream, by the way, they're kind of on the fringes, are simply not coming true. One of the things I do want to point out is that there are people, believe it or not, who have very strong financial motives for spreading fear of radiation. Not only are there some people that make money by protecting people from radiation, there's also an awful lot of people who make an awful lot of money by selling competitive products to nuclear energy. Nuclear up, coal down is a great message unless you're a coal miner or unless you're a railroad executive who runs a railroad that transports coal. So think about that. That's why you're never going to get to 100% support. But that's okay. Recognize you're in a competitive industry and don't be afraid to compete.
You can also...
I just have a quick thing. Two short things to say which are related. First thing is Rob Rock, I don't know if you're aware of this, but he's the incoming president of Environmentalists for Nuclear in Canada. So I left it. I was sort of acting, but he's now the official one, so he's got opportunities to use that to help communicate. The second point I wanted to make is it was made by, I guess, with the chief of staff of Obama early on. What was his name? The fellow from Chicago, the mayor.
Emanuel.
Yes. He said, never waste a serious crisis. And believe me, we have a serious crisis now. I mean, there's 70,000 people evacuated and they're not coming home. They're getting paid a fortune, compensation for their disability. 50 reactors were shut down in Japan. There's problems all over, and nuclear everywhere. So we have a serious crisis. So in a serious crisis, you can get things changed that you would never be able to do under normal conditions. So the point that he made and the point that we should remember is don't waste the serious crisis. We have an opportunity now to change things if we do it right. And we shouldn't waste it by letting it go by. So that's my...
I would point out that you're talking about how to handle the Harvey Wassermans and the security over the top.
And the people who believe.
Well, I mean, there's some things you can't do. I mean, there are other industries. Somebody mentioned GMOs. Others, cell phones. Where people think cell phones are bad. Where people think vaccinations are bad. Well, I mean, you can't mollify all these people. I mean, you can deal with it. You can deal with them respectfully and just by keeping your cool in a conversation and pointing out why what they're saying is a little bit beyond the pale. This is something I remember the day of Fukushima. I remember early in the Fukushima crisis, people like myself, people like Ron Adams, others predicted zero casualties out of this event. 1,000 days later, we're still right. It's possible to confidently do that without really engaging with some of the more hysterical aspects of what you're saying.
I agree with that, and in fact, you may want to start calling out reporters and editors who, anytime there's any nuclear-related story, bring up Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, and Fukushima. Every single time! So you have to challenge that. That's one. And the other thing is you actually have to say how many people died. 0, 0, 250 Chernobyl, maybe, first responders? Maybe, not even that many?
28.
Okay, so I'll just say roughly 200. And that's what I'm sticking with. Do you see? Do you see what the difference is? Another thing I think we need to be better about is not talking in the abstract. The things that we're talking about, nuclear energy is really example, when you're talking about radiation and risk, if you look at IDQ mining, for example, we have got some graphics. I think Steve, your unit of grams per
carbon intensity per kilowatt hour.
You know, it would be, I don't know what that means. And I bet that 99% of the people on the planet don't know what that means.
But the other 1% being Canadian energy is.
Exactly. So you know what would be better? If you had some sort of tangible, like equivalent. That's another thing. And lastly, with respect to the Fukushima thing, is I would also challenge reporters to talk about, well, how many people died in the tsunami and earthquake? I still don't know because the reporting is so horrifically bad around the whole thing, right? Because it's always about how many people supposedly died from the reactors, which was radiation-wise, right? 5 or 6 people, industrial accidents, or they tripped and fell, or there was something else going on. Okay, right, minuscule. So, yeah, I could go on, but I wouldn't.
I think, and this just gets back to a whole, I think, media strategy that includes a pretty fixed website. You have some great material to take the apocalypse off the table, which is really what we're talking about. But I don't see how you win this discussion. I don't see how you say Fukushima wasn't that bad, nobody died, when there's this whole evacuation going and people are out of the house. I don't think how you say Chernobyl wasn't that bad, so many people died, and there's whatever the name of that city is, that's empty. But there is radioactive wolves. This is a fantastic thing. The Earth was not hurt by Chernobyl. It was bad for people. And there's lots of film around Fukushima. Not so good for people who live there. Exaggerated, absolutely. I believe in, we have a phrase, I think, maybe created by my friend Bouchard, maybe not, called zombie dog. Which some advocacy for things we don't believe in bring up over and over. Well, we proved that when we published some ridiculous publication, right? And I think the study your organization had done for economics was a strong doc. That's a good doc. You don't have to have an extensive talk with people with economics who think a wind turbine looks beautiful and a steam tower looks horrifying, you know. You're not gonna convince anybody with numbers or whatever. You can just say, well, that's not true, and we've shown that here, and that's a great use of the web, not social media. I would say on social media, I spend a lot of time talking to people I don't agree with, and I think it's really positive. I'll give you one that really shocks me. Everybody can cover their ears. I will respond to tweets from Sean Patrick Stencil, because he will stay on topic. We agree to disagree, but he's not, well, that's not true, and then they change again. Some people aren't gonna buy him, but you do have to call out the ridiculous. You have to take the apocalypse off the table, you know. And you can't dwell on the topic. It's bad, you know, you can't say Fukushima was great.
I disagree with you.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Because all those people were evacuated. Jerry just handed me the old, you know, he's anti-LNT, and we're all anti-LNT, and that's why people were evacuated. And we know that politics is why people were evacuated, not because of science, okay? So that's, you know, now, is it horrible that all those people have been displaced? Yes, I hate it that they're displaced, and I hate that it keeps showing it, and the cleanup, it's politicized. The whole thing is politicized. It's completely out of control, and in part, the international nuclear energy industry allowed it to happen by backing off and letting Japan handle it, and setting these insane dose limits. And that goes directly to radiophobia and what is radiophobia the culmination of? I mean, you can't get away from that. That's all it is, okay? And so sometimes we do have to say the ugly facts on the ground are, we're not happy, no one is happy that anyone died. But let me also say that in the natural gas industry in the U.S., what is that statistic, right? It's okay, 35 to 70 people dying a year, that's okay for them. What kind of crap is that? What is up with the double standard? Nuclear exceptionalism. We know about that.
We live in nuclear exceptionalism.
One of the things that I've been able to do in social media is to find several really good, thought-provoking examples. Radioactive wolves is one, but I've got an embedded video on my blog of a young woman who was going to Chernobyl to tell a terrible story of, you know, how this thing happened and she was doing a video, and she noticed some smoke off in the not too distant, and realized that there were a whole colony of babushkas who had refused to be evacuated and gone back and were living off the land in Chernobyl and had been there for 25 years. And it's really hard for people to see a very healthy, matronly old woman who's saying, I like to eat. I eat my food out of my garden, and she's growing it in the contaminated soil in Chernobyl. So those kinds of things are something that you can find and share with people.
Sorry about that, but I think we have a question with Doug Hinkbeck, who, by the way, is a director of the OCI board.
Yeah, hi. Okay, yes. I just wanted to say, you know, I saw this Pandora's Promise recently, and, you know, they brought out some sort of traditional anti-nukes who sort of got religion and sort of spent more time and thought it out and came to some conclusion that's not all that bad. But I must say, one thing I was wondering was, just, you know, does this sort of thought process in the environmental community have legs and potential to grow? And as an industry association and as individual companies, how can we stimulate that? I mean, I wondered just how real it was. There were four or five people, and some of them made comments that, you know, they were kind of pariahs with their friends in the sector. Some of them, you know, suck it up and went anyway because they wanted to be true to themselves, and that was fine. But just how far do we think it can go, and what can we do to accelerate that and exploit what might potentially be a split in the environmental movement on this topic? I'd be interested in anybody in the panel's view on that.
I'll start real quickly. I think it's got some tremendous legs. I think that the showing of Pandora's Promise on CNN, I guess it was last week or the week before, they did a great job in showing some debates and building up to it, and showing that they, quite honestly, the younger environmentalists are questioning. It was a very interesting debate between Michael Schellenberger, who was one of the stars of the Pandora's Promise, and Ralph Nader, you know, the old school environmentalist, and really showed some examples. And I've been following a lot of conversations. It's got some legs, and it's something we need to keep driving forward. Getting the cognitive dissonance going, getting people saying, wait a minute, I really hate climate change, but I've been told I'm supposed to hate nuclear. I really hate climate change, but nuclear can power submarines. I really hate climate change, but why am I afraid of nuclear?
Yeah, I agree. A little while ago, I wrote a really critical piece about the David Suzuki Foundation and other position on nuclear. I got a comment from somebody at the foundation criticizing what I was saying, sort of demanding that I retract what they said, because they said they're in the midst of re-examining their position on nuclear. I took that as a really positive sign, and I had several other polite exchanges with this fellow, only to read in the papers in the last little while that quotes from David Suzuki himself that don't sound like he's changed anything. So there's hope, but you have to work at it. You just have to be patient, and you have to keep engaging and be respectful and polite, but bring up the facts.
I also want to point out, with respect to advocacy and communications, there are, I can think of at least five different audiences. The media, politicians, your regular person on the street, business, whoops, who am I missing? Yeah, I don't know. All right, and so activists, And so when you're crafting messages, you craft it specifically for that audience. There is no, you know, one thing we have a horrible tendency in this industry of doing is imagining there are silver bullets. This would be the thorium people, if, you know, come on. Thorium, you know, politics exists regardless of the thorium fuel cycle, people. You know, we could get the IFR going tomorrow, but the politics aren't going to change. The politics are messy. It's about people. So you have different messages and different strategies for delivering those messages to each one of the target audiences. Do you craft the majority or the primary thrust of your advocacy and communications campaign to antis? Absolutely not, right? Because any politician or any good political analyst will tell you, you know, there's so many people on one side, there's so many people on the other, it is fixed. It's everybody in between that you're really talking to. That's who you're trying to move. Nevertheless, when an anti says some crazy shit, you know, we can't roll over anymore. We absolutely can't do it. And we get to be angry about it. And we get to be passionate about it, just like I'm doing right now. You know, because it really, it just, you know, it drives me crazy. So while owning, you know, we have to own, there have been deaths. You know, people have died from nuclear stuff. Yes. But no one is innocent. No one's hands are clean here. Every time some anti-nuclear person is against nuclear, well, they're pro-coal or they're pro-methane, which we're using now. We're not using natural gas anymore. Think about it. And fossil fuels kills people. And that seems to be acceptable. Windmills kill. They kill birds. They kill bats. They drive people crazy, they cause epileptic fits, whatever it is that they do. Solar panels are, you know, what goes into a solar panel is, you know, carcinogenic times 100. So let's not, you know, no one gets a pass. And going to the people are stupid, well, of course, no, you know, no one wants to hear this. The average member of the public doesn't want to hear it. Okay, fine. But you can certainly, when you craft your communication strategies for policymakers and for lawmakers and regulators, well, this is a language that actually they do understand. They know. You know, nothing is 100%, and we're not saying that. Also, this hasn't come up yet, but I'm just going to go ahead and say it. Quit using the word safety and safe and safer. I know. Mind-boggling, right? I bet there's not anyone here whose company doesn't use those three words over and over and over in its marketing materials, even within the industry, to the public. Cut it out. Because science has shown the more you say it, the less the public believes it. Who doesn't ever say the word safe, safer, or safety? The airline industry? Planes have killed a lot of people. They don't say it. And the auto industry, believe it or not. Sometimes they do, but it depends on the demographic they're going for. So cut it out. Communicating about nuclear in different and creative ways. Just think about that. I actually challenged both the NuScale people, SMRs, and the Missouri Charge people. They're allied with Westinghouse. Missouri is a state in the U.S. I said, quit using the word safe. They didn't know what to do. It really bothers people in our industry. We don't need the record. The facts show it. Zero deaths. I don't know how much safer we can be. Anybody? How much safer can we be? Negative deaths? Is that, you know, and while we're twisting ourselves in knots to try to be safer, right? And the price goes up. Everything goes up. Rod and I mean, we talk about this in set, you know, it's like we don't even need to talk. We've had all these conversations.
Is how much money you want me to spend to kill fewer people? And that's really the biggest jump we have is economics.
We've got a question. It's Neil Alexander.
So
Rolls Royce.
I had another comment to make. your comment there about how much safer and can we beat negative deaths. Actually, as an industry, we are very much into negative deaths. If you add in the contribution we made to inspecting bridges, aircraft engines that keep people alive, radioisotopes from the medical industry, radiation of spices and herbs that we need to keep our food safe, and you add up the huge contributions we make to improving human life. And I think that's something we really should celebrate, and as an industry, is very much saving lives rather than contributing to us.
It's more than just power and bombs, it's all of those things that are passing. But nobody
has. Yeah, no, it is something we have not been good at telling you. But the comment I've been wanting to make for a long time is one around competition. I don't think we've spoken enough about that. And I'm not sure we focused on what the competition to nuclear really is at the moment. So here's my thought on what's been happening in Ontario. And I know there are people in the room that will know these statistics much better than me. And I'm not good at numbers. I'm not good at faces, I'm not good at names. Not really very good. Let's talk about solar. There's a lot written about solar. Well, solar over the last 5 years has moved from barely worth mentioning to barely worth mentioning. It's not a competition to nuclear power. It is not going to make a difference to a decision about nuclear power in Ontario. Wind power has moved from barely worth mentioning to two or three times barely worth mentioning. If we continue to expand it at the rate that they want to expand it, at the end of the 10-year planning period for the OPA, it's 10 times barely worth mentioning. But it's still not going to be a competition to nuclear power. In the same period of time, again, I might have my statistics a little bit wrong, we've watched gas go from 10 to 20%. And I think if you really look at what the OPA's plans are for when Pickering comes out, the replacement for Pickering is gas. And I think a lot of us, because we were old and we've watched this happen over a long period of time, we've always considered gas to be a peaking plant because it's an expensive fuel. Why would you go and use it for any other purpose? Gas is no longer an expensive fuel. That gas is now a baseload plant. And the gas industry have done a remarkable job of convincing everybody that they are clean. It's obvious gas is clean. You have it in your house, you burn it, it makes no contribution, therefore it's good. And they've got away with it. And I bet if you talk to people in Toronto today, they believe that gas makes no real contribution to the environmental challenges of the world today. But gas plants produce half of what a coal plant produces. They still produce a lot of CO2. And again, Steve, I'm not sure about my statistics on this, but I think if you look at the OPA's planning period, and I did ask them this question, and they kind of stared at their feet and failed to answer it. But I think after the 10 years of investment in green energy that Ontario is going to make, at the end of the 10-year planning period, our CIPK will have gone up.
Yes, it will.
Because we will be replacing nuclear and all the gas. So I mention it because I think it's really important to focus on who the challenge is and the message that we need to be getting across, and that is that gas is a contributor to greenhouse gases. Greenhouse gases are the most significant environmental challenge that we have in the world today. That's my observation.
I also would like to remind the competitors in this room that natural gas has also done a great job in convincing people that it's cheap and it will be cheap forever. But if you look at the history of natural gas prices, they're pretty volatile. They're almost as volatile as the substances itself. And one of the best ways to make a lot of money in natural gas is to be producing natural gas during a price run-up. And when is the price run-up? When all of the other competitors have been knocked off the field and people are trying to both burn it in their stoves, burn it in their water heaters, burn it in their electrical power supplies, burn it in their industrial power supplies. They're trying to convert it to liquid for vehicles. They're trying to put it into vehicles directly. And in both your country and in my country, we're trying to export it to other countries. Think about what the price of gas is going to be if all of those things happen.
could happen. You're absolutely right. It's the number one competition to nuclear. That's what we should be focusing on. Somehow the debate has become, let's have gas because it emits half of what coal does, just like you said. That's not what that's not the debate that we should be having. The debate should be between a zero carbon source and a 550 gram per kilowatt hour source. 550 grams, that's half a kilogram per kilowatt hour. This is not insignificant. This is not a solution to global warming at all.
It's not clean, it's half as dirty as coal.
It's half as dirty as coal.
And there's a cost associated with that. Let's not forget that. And one of the things we can do, it's one of my little evil schemes, is to start to sow seeds of doubt about all these other power generation sources. They need to be just as regulated and safe as we do. So instead of a natural gas combined cycle plant costing whatever it costs, $3.5 billion, it should cost $5 billion. They need decommissioning funds up front. They need all of their facilities to be inspected just as much as ours are, because their shit blows up and kills people all the time, right?
Harden
their pipes against earthquakes. It's like, come on, and airplane crashes. That is correct. And if you don't think that will work, you don't know anything about, you know. And this is not, you know, there's an element to it that most people in the nuclear industry find very uncomfortable. Ooh, we're being like antis. But the fact is, the natural gas methane people, they have done it to us, and they do it all the time, and they don't care.
Hey, just a quick question. So we talk about how politics is the number one enemy for nuclear and the advancement of our industry so far, and we define politics as our local population as well. You also, Ms. Janetta, you also mentioned something about our five different target, and you mentioned as people, people as one of the targets we want to be able to reach out and talk to share some sort of activism. To bring change, we need our local population, and we need to connect to them through activism. I'm wondering, what are your thoughts about speaking to them in a common language, more so when they're younger, like in high school?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because right now, according to my sister, you know, she goes to high school, she saw a PETA video, now she's a vegetarian. But what are we doing about for energy, right? What are your thoughts?
No, I think that's brilliant. And in fact, I'm surprised I think the Cameco guy left. But, you know, like Saskatchewan, how do they not have mining and uranium as like a core curriculum, right, in all schools in Saskatchewan, because it's so important? Did they? Supposedly they just introduced them. So yes, you are right. Younger is better. You have the Canadian Nuclear Association in the same way that the American Nuclear Association, Canadian Nuclear Society, does that kind of education. They have all these programs. Yes, absolutely. Other things that we can do, you actually have to show up, you know, and you have to quit being in the closet about being nuclear, being working in the industry, and it's hard because you just want to punch people because they're so stupid and they say dumb things. I mean, my friends are like, if, you know, one of the things that polars will tell you with respect to fear of nuclear and fear of radiation is that it boils down to control, right? Like, people will drive their cars, something that could blow up, and they think it's fine because they're in control. Whereas, of course, it isn't fine, and, you know, there's lots of deaths from cars. So one thing we can do is to humanize ourselves. And it makes you feel a little better. And I think some of my friends, not all of them, but some of them are like, well, okay, you know, Vandria is pro-nuclear and she says it's great. Well, then maybe it is. Maybe I need to rethink it. There's a lot to be said for that, too.
Social media, Facebook and Twitter. We do advertise. We recently completed
also show up at meetings and hearings as well, so we do turn up. But I guess
we're going to sketch.
Anywhere, we do debates. Ron and I do debates. But I guess my concern is not that people are stupid. It's just that they don't necessarily care. And it's not that they have to care, but they don't necessarily care. And I guess in order to reach the people that may not care, I wonder about with respect to social media is, first off, if I could get a sense of how many people are following you on a nuclear file. And also, I wonder how polarized they are. So is it the people for and against? Are we, again, talking to ourselves? And Sean Patrick stencils, or do we have, how many people are we reaching who maybe didn't realize how great we are, and they're thanking you for the information you're providing?
Well, I'll answer that quickly. I think it's about 140, 150 on Twitter, and probably it's a third, a third, a third, which are economics of energy issues. I would think at least a third are opponents, are the wind industry and the renewables industry and Sean Patrick Stencils and people who want to keep dibs on what you're up to. And then a third are probably just, a third are probably the problem in my case. I would remind you, Pandora's Promise is not about people who weren't converted to.
I think with respect to your point about people just not caring, well, that's a much bigger issue for democracy everywhere, isn't it? We're in the infrastructure business, essentially, and most people, if they don't care, and one of the reasons they don't care, stupid is a catch-all. That's one of my catch-all terms, but no, they don't care. And so democracy is imperiled. But remember, the people who do show up are screaming and yelling and carrying on about how we're all going to get cancer and die. So if I'm a politician, if I'm an alderman, if I'm a council member, and I'm sitting there and I'm just listening to person after person saying everyone's, we're all going to get cancer and die, then I'm not going to vote for your project. And, I tweet, but I should do more. You guys do a lot. But actually, Rod's the champion, so let's hear what Rod's numbers are. And by the way, I've got I just like to talk. I know. Yeah, you do. You have to. You'll just have to take it away from me. But I have anti-nuclear followers.
I get a lot of anti-nuclear followers. I try to treat them with respect and engage in conversation. Many times, my philosophy is I'm not going to change their mind, but engaging in a debate with somebody and treating them with respect allows the observers of the debate to learn more and to decide who they think is more informed and has a more important philosophy. And when it comes to caring, I guess I'm a little different than many because I grew up caring very deeply about where my electricity came from. My father was a professional electrical engineer, worked for the utility company, and I always thought that was an amazing calling because whenever we had a storm in South Florida, Dad put on a hard hat, went out and put people's power back up. So that's always been an important part for me, and I try to share that story as many times as I can because you'd be amazed at how many people do have memories of what it is like to not have power in a modern society. If they've been I lived in Charleston when Hurricane Hugo came through and knocked out the power for 2 weeks. I've lived in Annapolis, Maryland. We lost power for a week. Even 2 years ago, we had this thing called a derecho that swept through the derecho. I'm sorry, I can't pronounce these things. But it swept through from Ohio all the way to Washington and knocked out, I think, 14 or 15 million people electricity. Mine was out for a week and a half. So people understand what it's like to not have power. And And then they start caring, as Jerry said, don't waste the crisis, don't waste the Superstorm Sandys and all those other opportunities to help people understand just how important it is to have reliable power.
I have a really pugnacious attitude towards people who are anti-nuclear, until I started realizing that in all my social and sort of semi-professional extracurricular activities, I attend regular environmental gatherings in Ottawa and several different groups. And I come from a very anti-nuclear family, and I work for people who are anti-nuclear. I've realized in the course of the last few years that my attitude towards them has become much less pugnacious, and my influence on them, if I can be so bold as to say that I have it, has started to have an effect. Like I said, I come from a very anti-nuclear family. I have anti-nuclear friends. That as I bring this subject up, I'm the type of person who just won't stop talking about it. And I don't think it's because I'm just wearing them down and they're trying to humor me. I think that I've, like, if you engage in a certain way, if it's respectful, if it's, I try to not be as disrespectful as I used to be, and I find that has a better, more positive effect on these people, to the point where my brother has offered, this is my left-wing anti-nuclear brother, has offered to write letters complaining about the FIT program. So that's, I regard that as a huge breakthrough. So, you know, one at a time.
I think we have time for two more questions.
Yes, the Consul General of India, Mr. Misha, would like to have a word.
Good evening, friends. I wanted to express my profound gratitude to Mr. Roberts for so kindly inviting me to what literally is an internal gathering. Before joining Forest Service, I studied engineering, I had a B.Tech and M.Tech in mechanical engineering. So how fascinated I found the discussion this evening. And I can share with you that I came to Toronto about 2.5 months ago, and I was a bit surprised to see the kind of debate on the nuclear issue that is happening in Ontario. Because in India, there is absolutely no proof in India that India has a large growing economy. India does need to go massively for nuclear energy. And at this point in time, in India has a very young population. About 25% is its median age, and 75% of its population is less than 35 years. So we see that in the coming decades, by 2030, India will have the largest labor force, and also it will have labor force by 2030. And the kind of energy requirement that we envisage, many people in India are not even anticipating the quantum leap in energy demand that we will have, because our manufacturing sector is very primitive at this stage because of poor infrastructure. But the government is working on $1.2 trillion worth of infrastructure projects in this current financial five-year plan. And maybe 5 years or 7 years or 8 years later, when this infrastructure is in place, then there will be a very massive jump in manufacturing activity. That will create huge demand in energy. And because we do not have other natural resources, we do have coal, but quality is very poor. We do have hydropower, but the resistance for big dams is growing, and we don't see it will be very easy for India to build big, huge dams as we did in the 50s and 60s. Oil and natural gas have their own concerns in terms of pricing and also in terms of their carbon impact. So therefore, we do see that we don't have any second opinion about India's need for nuclear energy. And I believe that if you look at the long-term picture, maybe 2 decades later or 3 decades later, then India is going to be the largest consumer of nuclear energy. And the growth of nuclear energy is going, energy and also for nuclear industry, is going to come from India. And that is why I'm very delighted that in just September, the two governments have finalized all the necessary procedural requirements for our civil nuclear cooperation agreement. Now we are fully empowered to initiate our discussion and go into substantive talks and substantive business deals. And I believe Canada must take a lead in this, because there are other countries, USA, France, Russia, they are quite active in India, and I feel Canada should be the leader, because you are a pioneer as far as the technology is concerned. You are a country which is very well known in India. Your technologies are familiar to us. And also, most importantly, your persona as a nation is very, very warm, very soft, very kind, very sincere.
And us.
Actually, I agree.
Absolutely.
I do agree.
And
I can say that.
Canada's soft power has huge potential to do business where many others might have difficulty. Absolutely. And for an Indian, it's far more easy, far more comfortable dealing with Canada than any country. That is why I'm extremely delighted and extremely grateful to Mr. Hart for inviting me. This is my very first occasion to interact with this distinguished group, but I do believe we will have more substantive discussion after you return from India. And this is a critical, it's a historic opportunity for Canada and India to play a strategic role in transforming lives of hundreds of millions of people.
Wonderful message.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
I just want to say, for anybody who's a distance runner in the group, you know that the race is not always won by the people who lead after the first couple of laps, right, Heather? So we may be a little behind, but we're starting to pick up the pace, especially next week, and you'll see great inroads from the Canadian industry in India. We'll take the soft, knowledgeable, sincere approach, and we hope that we'll help you achieve that huge amount of nuclear carbon to start.
Thank you. So we're a little bit over time, but
okay.
One last question.
Last short question, Gary.
We said something about people don't care. Well, we had a very interesting phenomenon in the last election. The people of Oakville and Mississauga were threatening to overthrow the candidate in the Mississauga South Riding. They've been pushing gas-fired plants there for 10 years, and I've gone to every one of those hearings, and I kept pointing out the issues, and I even asked them to see a copy of their safety report, which didn't exist. And so, it wasn't just me, there was the whole population of Mississauga South who were against these power plants being built there. And they had to, the night before the election, they went around and put mail in everyone's mailbox in the whole area there saying that the plants were canceled. And that, it cost $1 billion to get the candidate for Mississauga South elected, Souza. And he's curiously the Minister of Finance of Ontario, so he's now got to deal with that $1 billion cancellation cost for closing two nuclear plants in gas plants, sorry.
He's closing two nuclear plants.
That's right. Sorry. Freudian slip. The other thing I just wanted to touch on is we keep linking nuclear to a risk of health effects. We keep using the word risk, risk, risk. It's almost the same like safety, but risk is a negative word. There are benefits, and there's even biological benefits. And nobody wants to recognize it. I show it black and white to everybody, and people are afraid to recognize the benefits. It's so clear. It's not 10%, it's not 5%. It's a factor of 3. Factor of 3.
You have to go into 9 on that.
So I think we're going to go right into the networking reception. But before that, I'd like to thank our panel. I'll go in reverse order this time, to be fair. Scott Luft, the publisher of the Toll Down Blogs. Andrea Janetta, publisher of Fuel Cycle Week and also I Dig You Mining. Steve Atwin, publisher of Canadian Energy Issues.
To us Canadians.